Okay.
What do you mean?
Nothing. Being at 6 o'clock, we call the meeting in order. We'll start with pledge allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Go ahead. We got three things to add to the agenda. We have A21, sewer forgiveness request. C1, councilperson Wepner's resignation. And K1, hiring of the Casson Aquatic Center manager for 2026. Is there anything else? Okay. Hearing none, I will take a motion to approve.
I'll make the motion to approve.
Thank you, Ryan.
I'll second.
Thank you, Mel. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Consent agenda, is there any item on there? None, I will take a motion to approve.
Make the motion.
Ryan?
I'll second.
Thank you, Mel. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Up next, we have visitors council. We have Gary Swanson, electric department project.
So I'll just introduce Gary. Gary's working with us as a consultant. One of the priorities that the council discussed back in March as part of our yearly session, CIP session, is electrical project. We talked a little bit about generation and capacity issues. As council members are well aware, the city doesn't currently generate. We have been buying capacity at the market auction over the last 20 years, which has been very favorable. You know, it's been a great cost effective for us. Due to a lot of the baseline power retirements over the last 5 years, coal and natural gas primarily, that market's become more unstable. And so two of the last 5 years, we've had price spikes in the capacity market. So as I said before, one of the things that was identified was looking at these options. So we've gone through a lot of different things over the last year. And what we're looking at tonight is a project where we would be installing 2 megawatts of solar at the north side site by the sewer plant, as well as 2 megawatts of battery storage. We see the battery storage, if you follow the news at all, that seems to be a trend, because what they're basically doing is they're partnering renewables, which generate during the day, typically fine. And actually, the renewables in Casson match our energy profile very well, because that generation, like for example, our load peaks in the summer with air conditioning in the afternoon. So typically 2 to 7 p.m. we see a big spike in the summertime on a hot day. So that's also a peak time for generation from our solar. So that actually matches really well with our profile. The issue, of course, is those days when, and evenings, when it's not sunny, it's not windy. I've brought this up before. How do you deal with that? Well, one of the ways that the market is tending to trend towards is being able to store that extra capacity that's generated during the day. Xcel's doing it on a very large scale. We're looking at doing it on a very small scale, but it would be something that could be expandable. We want to, you know, and I'll let Gary speak more of the specifics. We want to keep this a little bit smaller because we want to make sure that it works for us. Because there are other options. There are other PPA contracts, you know, that we could say, hey, we're gonna do a long-term contract where it's a more expensive contract, but it would add that capacity. For example, right now we have 2 megawatts of nuclear power that we get from, you know, from Wisconsin, and that includes capacity because it's that baseline power. So, you know, obviously as we blend our portfolio together, we have to meet the state's guidelines for our carbon elimination. The state says that we actually have to be 100% carbon free by 2040. I'm not convinced that's a doable target, but obviously we're trying to make strides to try and meet that the best we can. So anyway, with that, tonight Gary's going to present that. He's worked with us over the last 3 months here. We really appreciate his work on this project, as well as that solar for public buildings. We're still waiting on those, I think, Gary, to hear back from the state on those. But anyways, with that, I'd say go ahead, Gary. We'll let him present, and then if there's any questions anybody has for him at the end, we'd be looking for some action on tonight.
Okay. I mean, up to the podium.
If you want to go to the podium, otherwise, well, you're fine. You're fine either way. So, or you can sit next to Ian. He looks a little lonely. So,
what do you prefer?
I think you're fine with that.
I'll be out in the parking lot. Call in for this one.
Yeah. There you go.
All right. Well, thank you, Mayor, Council members, for this opportunity. As Tim had said, we had looked at a number of different options for trying to battle some capacity costs. We've seen capacity costs go up tenfold, you know, in the last couple of years. So, what are the options available for you folks to try and control some of those costs? And that's what we've come up with. So, Ian, you want to next slide? This is just the quick agenda. I'll get into the meat with the next slide here as well. So, Now, Tim had mentioned, I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening now in the marketplace. One, many of the power plants out there are retiring. We're getting rid of a lot of the good power plants that are out there for a number of reasons. Most of them are EPA-related reasons. We also are seeing a major growth as well, primarily from data centers, AI, things of that nature are really pushing that up. We might see a 20% load growth in the next couple of years here in our region alone just due to all these data centers. So we're looking at less capacity because these big power plants are retiring. We're looking at more load. So there's a big deficit of load supply and demand that's out there. So what has that done? That has caused the capacity cost to increase. And what MISO is the regional transmission operator that handles all the big transmission lines here, making sure that we have power when we need them. And what they have done is they send out signals, and that's what this capacity option has done, is that they want capacity costs much higher to help entice people to do exactly what you folks are looking at. Looking at battery, looking at solar, looking at other forms of generation that can help offset some of these high rising costs. Just last year alone, we were looking at $30 a megawatt day, which is about $10,000 a megawatt for that capacity, and that has jumped up to over $200. So you can see a huge increase in cost. And of course, no one could have anticipated that they're going to go that high. And so we're in a unique situation where we can look at batteries, which we can get in a year. You can look at other generation forms as well, but many of the other generation forms out there take much longer to put in. A lot of the other municipal electric utilities in the state have diesel generators, but it takes 3 to maybe 5 years to get some of that generation in. We have environmental concerns with that. We also have cost concerns. Those generally cost more as well. And with the battery, it can go on and off quickly, and so we have a lot of other opportunities with the battery system that can help the town out as well. Next slide, please. So right now, Captain doesn't have any formal generation, but they've done a good job with contracting with various sources for capacity. And as Tim had mentioned, it had been relatively reasonable in the past. But now everything has changed and these prices are going up. So as I mentioned, we can put in generation, diesel or natural gas generation for the size community that you have. It's more costly, it takes a long time to get in, you have emission issues. Batteries are great, they're easy to dispatch, and there are many opportunities or revenue streams that we'll get into. And most importantly with the batteries is we still have tax credits that are available. Now you guys are public, you don't pay taxes, but they have what's called a direct pay, which will give you, in lieu of taxes, direct money back from the federal government. And that's why the batteries right now are critical and they look good, because we have a limited window of how long these tax credits, if you want to call them, direct pay, are still available. And so we want to take advantage of those that are available. Solar, on the other hand, solar is going to be operating during your peak hot days when the sun is shining, which is great, so that helps reduce some of your capacity. But it's not available all the time when you might need it. So solar is great for energy costs, and it's just not good for capacity. But here again, we have a last-ditch effort to put solar in and take advantage of these tax credits. So those same IRA tax credits or direct pay are available for the solar as well. And we're looking at anywhere from 30 to 40% credit that you're going to receive back from the federal government for these projects, based off of a formula which we can certainly get into. Next slide, please. So in order to get any type of generation approved, you still have to go through Xcel. Even though you're a municipal electric utility, you have to go through Xcel because you're connected with them and get what's called an interconnection agreement. And basically what that is you go to Xcel, you say, here's our project, here's what we want to do, and Xcel will do a number of studies to see how the electrons flow to make sure that your generation is not going to mess up their transmission lines out there and the power and the circuitry for all of that. We have decided with the size of these systems to make sure it is non-exporting, which means you will never have to send electrons and kilowatt hours out into the Excel system. It's always going to be absorbed here. And we did that on purpose because if you want to export today, this interconnection agreement might take 3 years to get through. And it takes, you know, now almost forever for these interconnection agreements through. And that would basically lose your opportunities and take too long to still get these tax credits that are out there or your direct pay. So going small offers a number of opportunities. It helps you test the waters with these resources and take advantage so you know you're going to get these credits. And it helps take care of some of the issues that you have with these rising costs. Capacity, by the way, in the past might have only been 5% of your total energy costs. And today, with these high capacity costs, it's over 30%. So it's a big chunk of what you guys pay for energy and that you need to pay. And this is something that everyone is dealing with right now as well. You do have, I know Tim has talked about the potential substation in the future if you get approval through Excel, put in your own substation. And then these interconnection agreements are all going to go away because everything you do is going to be within your system and it's going to be a lot easier to work with. So if that gets approved, which they're hoping to have an answer before Thanksgiving, which isn't far away, that's going to solve some of your future problems as well. And then with this project, we also are looking at potential expansion. So putting in a battery system that's 2,000 kW or 2 megawatts, it's great, but we want to make sure it's set up so that you can easily plug and play new systems in as you see the opportunity for that. Next slide, please. So as Tim had mentioned, this is going to go on your east feeder, and it's a great place to put it because your load now is always over 2 megawatts. So this, at most, is going to produce 2 megawatts from the solar. If you happen to have more, you could charge the battery, and bringing the battery and the solar together is a perfect way to make those work together. So to help with reliability, we mentioned we don't have to export, which is a great advantage as well. Next slide, please. So here's the summary of the bids, and we have a spreadsheet that we can go into all those details if you want. If you guys have 4 hours, we can go through that spreadsheet.
We have it in Dropbox. If you have questions about it, we can certainly go through it later.
Yep. Be glad to go through any of those calculations. But the high level, so we did receive three bids. One was with Tesla. Of course, everyone's heard of Tesla batteries. They have what's called a mega pack, a very good battery system. The bid came in at almost $3.5 million for a 2 megawatt system. They're domestic content, which means you can first get the 30% credit from the feds on any of these projects, but if it meets domestic content, means that most of it is built and made in the United States, you get another 10%. And so that gives you 40% discount. So your net cost after getting your direct pay back is just a little over $2 million for that battery system. Savings on that is about $1.5 million that you're going to save above and beyond the cost of the system. So we look at all the savings, and we can get into all those details, but that's what you're looking at, savings after you've paid for the system. The next bid came through, that was Epidana. The next bid that came through was through Ziegler. It's called Elm Microgrid. They're made in Houston, Dallas, Texas. They have not confirmed that they're domestic content, so all we could do in this analysis is assume it's just the 30%. They think it's going to be, so that will be gravy on top. But right now, because their system and what they had provided as a bid is a little bit larger system, you get a little bit more credit, and the degradation rate, or how much we lose in that power every year, is better than the Tesla. You're going to see actually more savings with that, $1.543 million. So you'll see even more savings than what you saw from the Tesla. So Tesla is a little bit cheaper. It's not quite as efficient of a system. So the Elm microgrid system looks like a more favorable system from the total savings standpoint. We did check both of these battery systems out, and they both are very large, the largest two battery companies, I think, in the United States. They've got tons and tons of applications out there, utility-type applications, so we're looking at some very good systems out there for your consideration. The last option, we call it a tolling option. They basically weren't going to charge you for the system on a dollar basis, but they would then charge you based off of $11.80 a kW a month with an escalator. And that was such a high rate. Yes, you don't have to pay for the system up front, but you would end up losing about $6 million with that tolling system. So obviously that wasn't a consideration. Next slide, please. Any questions on the battery before I get to the solar?
I do have one. On your second one, the Elm Micro, right now you're saying at 30%, but if they justify it as domestic, and it goes to 40, how much more would the savings be?
It would be another $1.5 million, roughly. So that would go up by another $1.5 million, just getting that extra 10%.
And would they be able to get you that certification?
They're working on it right now. They think it's going to take 3 months to do. How the certification works is we still have to wait until the project is completed, and then there's the forms that we need to fill out to go after these tax credits direct pay for you folks. So we have plenty of time for them to figure that out. They think they have all the right components, but what they have to do, and this is what Elm has to do, is they have to go through a third-party auditor, and they have to then determine that third-party auditor goes through all the calculations to say, yes, this component is 5% made in China and 75% in U.S. and whatever. They go through the formulas, and then they will certify it that, yes, it does meet or doesn't meet the requirements for domestic content. It's a very complicated system for that, but that's what they have to do so they can see. So right now, you've got some great savings. If they can get that extra 10%, which is a great question, we can get even more savings than what we have here. Any others on the battery? All right, solar. So again, we decided on a 2 megawatt or 2,000 kW solar system, and that's AC. AC is the power that you actually use. Solar is done in a direct current DC system that goes through an inverter, and then this is what you really see. So we like to look at what it really means to the system. So option number one is a solar system that would produce 84 million kilowatt hours over a 25-year period. And this system happens to be Helena. It's a manufacturer right here in Minnesota, the solar company. They do qualify for domestic content as well. And the total cost would be $3.5 million for this solar system. You get 40% discount, basically, like we talked about those credits before. And so you'd be looking at a little more than $2 million for your net cost for the system. This is strictly energy savings too. So it's look at it. You guys do a lot of wholesale power contracts with different entities to make sure you have power coming in to feed the town. This is like that, only it's a small portion of what you actually need. But it would save you about $7.7 million over the 25-year period. So if you look at your net cost divided by kilowatt hours, your cost for energy is about 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour. In comparison, today you might be averaging maybe 5 cents. I don't know, Tim, if you have a better number for where you're at, but you might be power all in, you're buying power at 5 cents a kilowatt hour right now on an average. So this is quite a bit below what you're paying. If you do too much solar, you might say, why don't we do more? Well, then you might have to export it. We'd have to wait 3 years to get that approved again through Excel, and we'd lose the tax credit. The tolling option again was just too high from the third provider, so we didn't even consider that. Option number two was a more efficient panel. They have what's called a tracker, so it actually panel moves with the sun, so you get more production out of there. But the cost was almost double for the system. It was $6.9 million with the 40% discount and the domestic content as well. It's about $4 million unit cost. So even though it produces more, the cost was so much higher. The savings isn't as high. You probably lose about $1 million of savings over that 25-year period. Any questions on solar? So this is just a summary of all the costs. When we add those two together, we're looking at a net price of $7.3 million for the battery and the solar combined, those two low bids. We have the cost after the grants of about close to $5 million, so $4.7 million. And then you'll see savings over the term of both of those at about $9.2 million of savings. So you'd have some great savings with these. These would help keep your costs down and provide some more reliability in town. Not that you guys have any issues with reliability, but it's nice having some of the generation there. And both of these options would be installed then next year. Next slide, please. So one of the other benefits of doing this project now is we talked about these tax credits, direct pay that's available. We have a certain number of things we have to do to get the project started before the end of the year to still qualify for these, and I'll get into some of those quick details. But one of the things we want to look at doing is you have to anyways install, we'll call it a backbone feeder. You have three feeders that feed the town. And right now, if we were to install one that connects all three of those, the backbone feeder, then you have the ability to transfer loads from feeder to feeder, which gives you a lot more options. Say someone drives a truck into one of your main feeder lines and that line goes down. Well, you could have issues with loss of power, but if you tie these together, you can quickly switch one to another. So it gives you a lot more internal in town reliability. The reason why that would be good to look at now is because we could tie that to these two projects, saying this is needed to make sure that you have the solar and battery tied to all these circuits, and then you could get a 30% or 40% discount on that line. So it'd be a good opportunity now. You have to do it anyways. Maybe that's something we want to add into the mix and see if we can get some more tax credits and get a discount basically on that. All right, next. So the tax credits we talked about, 30-40% discount. The old rules gave you another 10 years to put these projects in. But with the Big Beautiful Bill was passed, they were limiting these credits that are available. And you basically have to start in one way or another these projects before the end of the year. And that's why we're coming with this pretty fast and furious to see if we can still get these in. Batteries are less certain. But what happens after the first year, it's called FEOC, Foreign Entity of Concerns rules that haven't even been written yet. We'll know what those are in January. Right now, if everything is as is, we really don't have to start the project for batteries until June of next year. But if something were to be written into these FEOC rules, we want to look at what we can do to make sure we're 100% locking in these credits. So there's a few things we are going to recommend that maybe you do to safe harbor, they call it, or grandfathering these things in. Otherwise, if we just wait for some of the stuff, we might lose the chance of have the chance of losing these credits. Next slide. And then we also need, as we talked about, is the interconnection agreement. That we need right away, and that's what the developers would do, is file for that interconnection agreement so that we make sure that Xcel doesn't have an issue, and they're not going to come back and say, oh, by the way, you guys have to improve this line for $10 million, and that would kill the whole project. So So that has to be done quickly and in order, and that's what we'd be doing with this, the system, is if you guys were to approve this, you could approve it on a contingent of the interconnection agreement being approved, so that you're not subject to having to pay for the whole project without these credits that are available. So that could take a month or two, but we have to get some of that going ahead of time. And then there's a couple other things that we have to start in these projects before December 31st, assuming the interconnection agreement doesn't get approved in time, which we know from the substation project how long Xcel takes to look at some of these things. Next slide. So here are some of the options. If you are going forward with the project, the low bidder has said that they're okay with doing the interconnection agreement and their engineering work ahead of time. If by chance Xcel comes back and says this is going to cost another $10 million and kills the project, what they're asking for is up to $100,000 in engineering fees paid by you folks. So that's what you'd have at risk. You say, we want to go forward with this. We think it's a great project. We can't approve the contract with the vendors until we get the interconnection agreement, but let's get them started because they have to fill out the interconnection agreement paperwork. So that would be the first risk that you have. It's up to $100,000 if everything were to fall apart. And we don't anticipate that because we're not exporting. It's a relatively small project. Everything should be fine, but you need to know what all the risks are one way or another. next slide. Option two, which is what we would recommend, is having the vendors order switchgear or transformers. If they order switchgear or transformers today, that gives you a 99.9% lock-in for these grants. So one of the rules in the Big Beautiful Bill says, you guys, if you start ordering this equipment, then we know it's a real project, and that constitutes a start of a project. So for that, then again, if everything were to fall apart and these vendors ordered this equipment, it could cost $500,000, and it'd be maybe $180,000, call it restocking charge for this equipment because they're not going to use it. And your net risk then would be about $280,000with these two combined. So that's what you'd be looking at. And then the last slide, option three, you could do in lieu of these is just start physical construction, which means maybe we could put a pad down for the battery, maybe we could put some posts in for the solar and do some of that work so you can see it physically has started. So those are kind of your options that you want to weigh and look at for making sure that you're still going to get these tax credits and this project can go forward. So that's pretty much what I had for the presentation.
Any questions anyone has for Gary or any questions about the project? I will say, you know, this has been a long project in coming. We've been reviewing this for quite a while, and you know, at a staff level, we do feel like that size project is going to be a good start for what we've talked about in the past, having our own capacity coverage. So.
Which of the risk options are you recommending?
We're recommending the 2 megawatt battery, the 2 megawatt solar.
She said which risk option?
Sorry, the risk option.
Oh, the risk option. I'm sorry. I think we want to have the transformers or the switchgear ordered, okay. So that is a little bit higher risk for you. But it does really assure that you're going to get the credits, and that's really what this is all about. And I don't think the risks are very high, you know, at all. We've talked to the vendors; they can get this stuff ordered. The companies that would be building switchgear or transformers, they can do what they need to do to make sure that they've got the paperwork back that says the project has started. If you do physical construction, that could be cheaper, but how many posts could you have to put in? You know, we're looking at it. I can't remember the number. It's well over 1,000, a couple thousand panels. How many of these posts we have to put in will qualify? And if you put them in now, we don't know if they're in the right situation because they all have to be engineered. So probably we'd have to put them in. Someone would probably maybe have to pull them out, readjust them, I just don't think that's a good option. So I like the option of ordering switchgear or transformers so that qualifies and you have the best opportunity for getting the tax credits, the direct pay.
So if we order the equipment, it's just a 25% restocking fee if it falls through?
We were told by the vendor it'd be about $180,000 potential burn. And that all depends on, if something were to fall through like 2 weeks into it, and again, I don't anticipate, there probably wouldn't be any restocking because they really haven't started building. So if we're a week from them having this completed, you know, someone has to reuse this equipment. They may have to do some things, so there will be some, you know, some cost. But that's what the vendor has told us. They don't think that would exceed the $180,000 for this project.
Well, your slide says $121,000, so.
What's that?
Your slide says $121,000 for a restock.
Oh, that's the, I sent a new PowerPoint that had the updates on there. Sorry. That was the old estimate that I had, and then I finally got something from the vendor that said $180,000.
Okay. I just verifying.
Apologize for that.
Want to make sure we're looking at the same one.
Yep. So it's $100,000 for the engineering, $180,000 for the equipment. So max, call it risk that you might have is $280,000.
Oh, so we'd have to do the engineering part and?
You'd have to do the engineering as well, yeah. Because that would be the vendor's cost for, and it'd be up to. So it wouldn't necessarily be 100, but it'd be up to. Both things are up to, but
okay.
You need to know what your max risk is.
So just to make it more clear, if you would have put that all as one option instead of two, because you're saying option one is an engineer cost, and you're saying option two is a restock, technically that's only one option. So it's more confusing when we're looking at this.
I understand. I apologize. I apologize for that. So you could just do the engineering, and what could happen is when these new rules come out for FEOC, that might change some of the stuff, and we've lost that opportunity. So that's lower risk, but for cost for you folks, but it's a little bit higher risk of not getting the project approved. Because if you don't get these tax credits and the direct pay available, this project's going to be very difficult to go forward.
It would be much more costly to lose out on the grant opportunities.
Oh, yes.
Than
exactly.
With option one, yeah. My question was, have we seen any cities do this, put the switch gears in, or they get to that 99.9%, should get the funding, grant funding from the government, and not get it?
No, we haven't, but these rules are relatively new, so I don't think anyone has gotten to that point. The rules of what you need to do to still qualify for these grants, the tax credits, really came out maybe a month and a half ago.
Okay.
So it's a pretty much a very, very new a new rule that has come out that people are working with.
Might not last very long. And it might not last very long, it sounds like. Okay.
Yeah.
Estimated timeline, if we started this process today, when would the estimated completion date be?
You'd be looking at, for the battery system installed by November, so next year for sure, and maybe October for the solar. So both would be installed next year.
So theoretically online in time for next winter.
Right. And that's important because for you to get the credit, this accreditation for it, you need to, by that time frame, you need to turn that into MISO to say, we now have new generation, please give us credit for next year.
Okay.
So next summer you won't have it, but at the following year you should have the accreditation and have that relief with this capacity available.
This might be a question more for Tim, but if we went with option one, which was at $7.291 million, with that savings of, well, total cost with grants, 4.7, where is that coming from? Is that something Mike Bavani needs to sit with us on? Or?
Sure. So the electric fund doesn't have any debt. We retired our last debt in 2023, so very likely we'd be going to the debt markets. We'd use some cash, we would pay some cash down. So the way a lot of these projects work is, as far as I know, Gary can correct me, the tax credit is a kind of a repayable thing. So we would basically, in essence, front the money. We'd see those costs, we'd work with Mike to time out when we would want to go to the debt markets to pay the residual amount of cost that's there. And then that would be a bond. It would not be it wouldn't be a general fund bond like some of ours have been in the past. It would be electric revenue bonds. So it would be paid by revenues coming from the electric department. Any other questions?
No, I'm good.
Otherwise, we'd be seeking approval pending the contingent agreement with Xcel, the interconnection agreement.
We'd have to pick an option?
And our recommendation would be to go with the low option, the lowest cost option.
The one about 280.
The ones that are highlighted?
I'm sorry?
Sorry, the ones that are highlighted?
It'd be the, on the last, second, you just got a slide there.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it'd be your two lowest, they're both Ziegler. It'd be a Ziegler Solar and a Ziegler Elm Battery. Those would be the two that we'd be approving.
Yeah, the combined price was $7.3 million before the grants come through. And that's the other thing that's nice. Those are both with the same company, so that getting into the design of this, everything will fit together. And there won't be single finger pointing. Well, that doesn't work because that's someone else and that's someone else. And sure. Ziegler has been around for 100 years. They do generation. They do these projects day in and day out. Some of the other folks out there, we don't know how long they're going to be around.
Is there, I'm thinking of our community, is there a way to turn this into like a 7th, 10th grade level presentation to give to people in town so that they can understand what this is and why we're doing it? I know we've talked about it a lot, but oftentimes we hear that sometimes citizens aren't really quite sure what we're doing, or they don't know it because they're not hearing all of this the way we do. Is there a way that we can have this presentable for them so that it's understandable and relatable for someone that doesn't spend the time that we do or Tim does, our electric department, on these type of numbers and activities?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I could sit down with Gary and we could take these slides and we can modify it a little bit, make it a little easier to understand for folks. Like you said, it's one of those things where, you know, when you spend a month on it, you know, after a while you kind of understand what they're talking about. But even some of the terminology, that might be something we can add for a public presentation, would be like, what does capacity mean? What does, you know, I know prior to my experience, you know, working with this, you know, a megawatt versus a kilowatt versus a, you know, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that'd be a problem. I think we just
want to. I just want to make sure we're, if we move forward with this, we have enough information to share with the public where they understand it. And
sure. And I mean, it's not going to impact, you know, they're not going to really see a lot of this. You know, we'd love to take people out there and show them,
yeah,
you know, the batteries and things like that. But I mean, it isn't going to be, you know, we're not changing the rates to do this. In fact, this should actually be a cost savings long term. So in essence, we're buying down the cost of power.
Yep.
You know, we're saying instead of spending, like he had a couple options where it was like 6 cents a kilowatt or whatever.
Yep.
Instead of doing that, we're putting a certain amount of money into this, and then we'll have a lower cost of power going forward.
Yep.
So it's you know, basically buying the cost down. So in the long run, it should be, it shouldn't affect our rates any.
Yeah, positive.
But that's the, I mean, I certainly think I can sit with Gary and we can come up with
a little. I think that would just help people to reassure them and make it knowledgeable for everyone.
Sure.
I mean, the truth of it is we've been discussing this, or City Council has been discussing this since 2014.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's been over 10 years.
I mean, I remember attending that meeting even though I wasn't on council.
Yeah. Back then we had numbers back at the time to put up a 1 megawatt. So now we're looking at 2, but we had up at Public Works. We had looked way back then.
And it was way more expensive.
Back then, yes. But we didn't have the savings.
Right.
I think with the savings and the grants that are available now that just started not long ago, I think it will behoove us to jump on board with this now if we're going to want to get this project to fruition. It's a good idea to jump on these savings so we can get them.
Contingent on?
Interconnection approval with Xcel.
Yep. Okay. So you're looking for a motion?
I would be, yes.
Okay. I would make a motion that we approve the option one as presented in the presentation.
Subject
to
the interconnection
agreement with
Xcel.
And I will second.
Any other discussion? And do we have to decide what option we want as far as going forward?
No, I mean, we'll take, I mean, I've got direction from you on moving forward with the project.
Okay.
And we'll fine-tune some of these things to make sure that, you know, I'll sit down with Gary. You know, it sounds like he's recommending doing that network backbone ordering, stuff like that, and I don't see a reason we wouldn't do that, but we'll talk to some of the tax people, too, to make sure that we're qualifying and stuff like that, so.
Okay. We had a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks, Gary. Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you, everyone. Appreciate it.
Just bear with me. Up next, Mayor's Report. You'll be noticed this evening that Councilperson Wepner is not here. He has sent in his resignation for city council due to he is no longer a resident in the city limits. With that, I will take a motion to approve his resignation.
Thank Brian for all the work he did.
Yes.
The time he spent, so I will make that.
Second.
We have a motion second. All in favor?
Aye.
I'd like to make sure we reach out to Brian and tell him thank you for good luck in his future.
Good night.
And with that, I would like to open up for applications to fill a seat for the next year until the next election. And I would like to take those and then bring forward a recommendation to the council in one of the next two meetings to replace him.
Do you think that we will be able to receive enough applications to make a determination within the next two meetings?
Yes.
Are they back-to-back, the next two?
The next two meetings are December 3rd and 10th.
Right.
I think you're looking at January.
And then, then it would start in January. We would
swear in January.
You know, get the recommendation, come back, council vote on it in one of the next two meetings.
Okay.
And then we would let have swear them in January.
If there's more than one applicant, we'll sit and talk about them here at a meeting and then look at their resumes, or are we going to have them come?
I will interview them and bring back a recommendation is what I'm recommending. Unless you have other.
No, I'm just curious. I'm fine with that. Trust your judgment. Tim, you'll be part of that as well?
Yes.
Yeah, I'll certainly take a look at them. At the end of the day, you know, it is up to the council. You'll make the decision on approving it or disapproving it, but hopefully we'll have some quality applications. And we have in the past. We've been very fortunate to have some customers that have joined through the appointment process. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. We'll go with that. Up next, public forum. I've got no cards. Committee report, Planning Commission cannabis zoning ordinance.
All right, so I've got a few things to discuss with the cannabis zoning ordinance. The Planning Commission did have a public hearing back in October. There were a couple of questions that came up during that meeting. The item was tabled until November. At the November meeting, there was a recommendation for approval from the Planning Commission. So included in your packets is a redlined version of that ordinance. You'll notice just a few things in there that have been updated since the Planning Commission meeting. First of all, just clarifying some of the under Section 3 cannabis and hemp business activities general provisions, just clarifying cannabis retail establishments rather than just regular establishments. Ventilation systems are to be consistent with the Office of Cannabis Management at the state level. Let's see, more clarifying terms, specifically for the buffers that we talked about, 1,000 feet from a school, 500 feet from a daycare facility. That's been further defined to mean a child care facility serving 13 plus persons, so not just a daycare facility more broadly. Let's see here. And then there was one question that came up during the Planning Commission about outdoor cannabis cultivation. In the proposed principal uses table, you'll see that outdoor cannabis cultivation is only proposed to be permitted within the development holding zoning district. And so the question was, well, what does that mean then if you have a development holding district option that's within a buffer distance? And so it was felt that outdoor cannabis cultivation should not be allowed within the buffer distance from a school. So that's specifically been defined there.
So there is very, very little space where one could cultivate, if I'm looking at this map correctly.
Right, yeah. So the way that the ordinance is written now, it's not just cultivation, but it's like any cannabis or hemp business wouldn't be allowed within the buffer distances from the school. Or daycare facilities. So, like, for example, on the map here, there are a couple pieces over here by the school district were in question. Some land owned by Mr. Dean Schutte within that area, which is being used for farmland now. With this proposed ordinance, no cannabis would be allowed to operate within that area. But there are other development holding districts that are outside of the buffer distances, mostly on the south side of town. And then I also wanted to discuss this zoning map as well. This map isn't meant to be part of the ordinance. It's more of just a visual guide. This was the original version here that has dots specifically for the attractions within public parks. So, you know, that could be anything from like a soccer field to a pickleball court to a shelter, any of those types of things. But the Planning Commission, it was felt that maybe the dots are not restrictive enough. And so that was something that we looked at, whether we could include like the entire parcel and then start the buffer from there. But looking at state statute, it was determined that we couldn't do it that way by using the entire parcel. But what we can do instead is like increase. So instead of dots, you have like the entire baseball field or the entire football field instead of just a dot. So it does increase it slightly, but based on how the zoning districts stay out, that's not really a material difference anyways. That's what I've got. Any questions?
Scroll to the top, Ian.
Yep.
Is there a reason it cuts right, I'm assuming, right up underneath the number 57 for the highway, that rectangle to the right there, go down?
Right.
Is that Zed?
Yeah.
Is there a reason it stops at the Zed line and doesn't extend past Zed like it does for the school district?
Well, we'd be outside of our
we're outside of city limits. That's like, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, just making sure.
Okay. Yeah, Zed is the limit. And then we'd be looking for a motion to approve if there's no other questions.
Any other questions?
Okay. Does the clean CR have, with its new regulation saying that hemp and liquid THC can't be sold, will that impact any of this?
Well, that is a good question. I'm not sure if I have the answer to that.
Okay. I know, like, we sell it at our local.
Well, there'll be another year before that goes into effect, okay. And I think it drops it down to 0.04%.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Separate then. Okay.
If it's on everything or just partials.
Okay.
But it's another full year. I do know that. Okay. To get into compliance.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sure there'll be a lot of more questions between now and then.
Yeah. It'll really happen all at the same time.
Well, if no other questions, I would take a motion to approve the new proposed cannabis buffers.
I will make the motion to approve the new buffer zones.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And then we'd be looking for a second ordinance, for the, a second motion for the zoning ordinance, I think, right, Ian?
Yeah, for the entire cannabis zoning ordinance.
That's what all the edited changes to it, okay.
Yeah.
I'll make the motion with the changes that were presented.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
There you go, Ian.
Thank you.
That's it for committee report, old business, the cannabis business ordinance.
Stay on the cannabis train here.
Still on the cannabis, yes. Let's see, just pull up that here, one moment. Thank you. So in your packets, you've got the proposed ordinance there as well. So, this one, pretty much the same definitions there that were included within the zoning ordinance. A lot of this is just copy-paste from state statute. Let's see, it lays out the the registration process that we'll be implementing here at City Hall going forward. We did have that one registration came through that the council approved previously. Goes through annual compliance checks, renewal of registrations, suspensions of registrations, various other requirements for cannabis retail businesses and so forth. Temporary cannabis events, all of that good stuff. Any questions?
Our motion to approve.
If we have no more questions, yes.
I'll make a motion to approve the ordinance for chapter 115 cannabis businesses.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Up next, fee schedule.
Sure. This is our second reading, our second look at this with updates, including the utilities for 2026. One that's highlighted below is the parkland dedication. So we discussed that at our last meeting. One of the questions that came up is what percentage we estimated this would cover. It's going to be about 36% of the overall park need. So included in your package, you have that park CIP plan from our planning session earlier this year. So we know that we're still going to have to, even if we make this change, we're going to have to supplement the park fund. And one of the things we talked about at our last meeting was utilizing some of those liquor store dollars to more directly supplement that so that we can show value for that business. So anyway, what we are planning on doing is leaving that industrial commercial use the same as it is right now, and then the biggest changes there would be related to the single family and the multifamily under that parkland dedication. And then other than that, you've got a copy of all the different fee changes that are related to two different things.
Okay. Any questions for Tim on those? Do we need a motion for? So I would take a motion to approve the fee schedule.
I'll make the motion.
Mel?
Second.
Ryan? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion passed.
Thank you.
So that's all of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Up next, personnel policy.
And do you want to speak to this one?
Yep, this is the second time you've seen this since the first time the decisions were made to split the cost and the updates then were made. It was mostly to the Minnesota paid leave. So that was the big changes in there, and that has now been updated to comply with the state law and what the unions had agreed to.
Okay. Any questions for Linda? If not, I'll take a motion to approve.
I'll make a motion to approve the policy handbook.
Ryan?
I'll second.
Thank you, Mel. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Well, that's there. Next new business, contractor truck and accessories.
Sure. Including your pack, you've got a copy of the information. Earlier this year, we were estimating the cost to be a little bit higher, so we were able to bring the cost down. We're anticipating having this order go in, but we would anticipate not having the cost paid until the 2026 year. based on their timeline that they've got there, and you've got Ben's memo in there, so you can kind of see what the costs are. The trade-in value for the current vehicle would be $7,500, that's reflected on that second sheet in your packet there.
Yeah, and I do like that he's putting a plow on it, so you'll be able to do a little bit bigger lots, maybe faster.
Right.
And more efficient around town. Sometimes you don't need to send the big truck out. Do we need a motion?
Yeah, you're looking for a motion to approve the low estimate there, or the low bid.
Make a motion to approve that bid.
And that be for the truck, the plow, and the sander?
Yes.
That's right.
Just making sure. We have a motion, do we have a second?
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. That is good. New business, we have a leaf ordinance.
And I can speak to this just a little bit, I'll also let Linda do that. One of the issues we've had this year is that we've had a lot of folks, unfortunately, putting grass in the road, and more so than I've seen in the last 5 years, and more direct, you know, obviously I mow my yard, and you know, sometimes there's some grass that gets in the road, but we've seen people, folks dumping in that. That's a problem for our stormwater system. So I think, Linda, you can speak to it. I know Ben came and Linda wanted to bring an actual ordinance that allows the police department to have a little bit more enforcement ability.
Yeah, that's how this all came up, is Ben came in and wanted to be able to state, this is what the city says. There is a Minnesota ordinance, which is referenced in the ordinance, but it's not specific to leaves. It says debris, garbage. So we just made it a little more specific, and it's real similar to then the snow ordinance also. Not piling snow in the street, not putting your leaves into the street.
Because isn't it against state law to snow blow or shovel your snow? Yeah, and you or even to plow it when you have a truck and you pull it out and push it across the street. Because I've seen contractors do that. They'll pull it out of the lot and push it up across the street. We want to make sure people are aware of that also, that that's illegal. Do we have any questions for them? If not, I would take a motion to approve.
Make the motion.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Will we put a notice in for people to remind them somehow of this? So that
well, sure, yeah. No, that absolutely is something we'll post, and then we're going to put the snow ordinance up as well, just reminders that, you know, the policy, and we did get registered with a couple of the TV stations, so we're hoping to be able to post that out, that the snow emergency will been called, that hopefully folks will get a little bit better message that way.
Thank you.
And then now the police department will have one more thing to write tickets for. Okay. Administrator's report.
Sure. I'll try and keep this brief because I know we've got other things to talk about. We do have the audit schedule, so that's going to be coming up. We field work in January and then end of March, beginning of April, field work, and then we're planning on getting that. Sarah's gung-ho. She wants to get that audit report done and to the council by the 22nd meeting of April, so we're hoping to get that a little earlier this year. I think I did send out, let everyone know that we were fortunate. Not just fortunate, it took a lot of hard work and a lot of time from staff. We were awarded with that $500,000 grant from the state of Minnesota for the Gaston Crossings 2 infrastructure. So we're really excited about that project. I'm not sure that it will start next year, but it's more likely to start in probably 27, but we'll work with Brandon on that. But that'll extend utilities to that 20 acres. That's the residual parcel that's at Gaston Crossings. Folks may have received a lead line inventory letter in the mail. I know this is actually the third round of letters. The state of Minnesota and the federal government require us to send those out. We've identified a couple of folks who thought they have lead. We went out and tested. We haven't actually had any, as far as I know, any positive results yet, but we're going to continue to do that. As we go through, we're able to eliminate those folks in the list, and then we always tell people the sooner you get it checked, the sooner we can cross you off, the less letters you're going to get. We don't really like sending letters out, but it's just a requirement. The state sends it out. Every time we do it, people go, oh, no, I've got lead. Get yourself registered, get it checked, and then it's done. It's mostly for homes that may have been built before 1980. So typically, homes before that period of time I know your neighborhood, I know, I think your new neighbor, you know, actually talked to us a little bit, but, which is great, because we want to get up there and get it checked. Because if there is an issue, there is potentially some grant money, some funding from the state that we can utilize to get those lines replaced. Because if somebody does, we certainly want to get that replaced. Legislative priorities, the League of Minnesota Cities, I won't go through all that, but you can kind of see, I know this year LGA is going to be something that's going to be a bit of a hot topic. And then boards and committees, we have some vacancies. You know, we have folks that say, hey, you know, I'm interested in what's going on in the city. I'll just encourage them to apply. I know we have a couple of vacancies coming up on the library board. I talked to the library director, and he certainly wants to try and get some people in there. We have vacancies for Planning Commission, Park and Rec, and the EDA currently, as well as obviously the council. But so we'd love to have people who are interested. It's a great introduction. The meetings are not hard. They don't, you know, it's not necessarily long. And we just love to have people in the community because we want to hear what they have to say. Park dedication, I talked about that. Strategic planning for CMPAS, attended that, as well as we approved a budget today. I'll have that information. I'll get that sent out to council. I'll get it scanned in and sent out, and then the fee schedule. I do have a couple other items. If you go into Dropbox, you can see there's the finance report. Appreciate Sarah getting that to us. Thanks for that. And then the other item I have is this Bingham Lake. So going back to the power, so as you know, our power contracts, most of them are running concurrently through 2030 and 2032. So we're starting to have those start to drop off over the next 5 years. So one of the things that the folks at Compass do for us is they identify new resources. So what I'm looking for tonight would be approval to enter into a PPA with this Bingham Lakes, which would be the purchase of wind energy. It's a repowered wind farm out in western Minnesota. We have a couple of wind contracts right now. So we'd be looking for permission of that. And the caveat would be the second document there under H3, which is it would be approval from the city attorney on this legal template. So I'd be seeking your approval to enter into the contract pending her agreement and sign off on the legal template.
I'll make a motion to enter into the contract subject to city attorney reviewing the legal document and approving it.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you very much. Appreciate that. That's all I've got tonight, but I'll take any questions anyone has.
With Ryan no longer on council, are there any board openings that we need to fill in for him in the next month? Or do we feel like those will be
all right? No, I think he's on the EDA, but I think, obviously that meeting will still take place, but I don't know if we'd absolutely have to fill his.
Right. I didn't know if you wanted
to. They just would have one meeting in December, and I don't think that would be a huge issue, but what do you think, Ian?
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, if one of you is interested in joining the EDA,
you know,
there's a spot open.
I like the ones I'm on.
For council member, so anyway.
Okay. And the engineer is not here tonight.
I do have to present some information for you. This is related to the grant under the Highway 14 bypass. So he has let me know he had an unfortunate issue he had to go take care of. It's the same program as we utilize on the 16th Street Roundabout and the Highway 57 urbanization from 11 to 16. It's a competitive grant application. We're applying for 100% of the construction costs. We would pay for the engineering costs. Included in there, you have a graphic of what it would look like. We're proposing that would be along the east side of Highway 57 and would connect in to that newly installed trail section that's Kitty Corner from Quick Trip. It would upgrade the shoulder along Highway 57 to a shared use with pedestrian ramps, and it would go from the north side of that Highway 14 interchange to the park and ride. So we're not guaranteed, obviously, to get this, and you're under no obligation to accept it if we do get it. But we want to be able to put the application in. We think that it's definitely utilized by a lot of folks, and it's going to be a growing number of folks as we see construction. You know, we'll start on that Cass and Crossings 1 with Mr. Schrader in the south side of town.
It's definitely a need.
It's been something we've been discussing for a while, maybe a couple of years.
Any questions anyone has on that?
Yeah.
Any questions? Otherwise, there's a resolution there.
Yes.
Resolution authorizing submittal for the LPP, the local partnership program.
There's no questions. I'll take a motion to approve.
Make a motion to approve the resolution.
Thank you, Ryan.
I'll second.
Thank you, Mel. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay.
And then under personnel, that's what it
is. Yeah, I saw that. Yep. So under personnel is the hiring of the Casson Aquatic Center manager for 2026. You will see in there some information.
We had our park board meeting yesterday. Ben brought the applicant's name up to us. He'd met with the applicant. The applicant has swimming coaching experience. So he has been WSI trained in the past, so he's worked with lifeguards. We're excited, and he is also a teacher in the district, so it's nice to have someone that knows the kids that work there. So we definitely thought this would be a great candidate when we met yesterday. So I would make the motion to approve the hiring of the aquatic manager for the 2026 season.
Second.
Just on that, too, what would the rate be?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
I do not know. We discussed it. It would go up based on minimum wage increase, a percent, but I can't remember what it was.
I can check and get back to you on that.
Yeah, if you wouldn't mind.
Yep. Whatever our first-year manager made last year plus whatever percent they had to do for the state.
Right. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Anything from our attorney?
Not tonight.
Okay. With that, next we will be having a public hearing for the Nori appeal of our fence UP revocation. Would like to highlight.
So included in your package, you have a couple of items. Mr. Nori's letter for his appeal, as well as the revocation photos, as well as the items related to his appeal, the different criteria we laid out, the resolution that was approved in September. You'll remember that we had this fence CUP, which was predicated upon agreements with the neighbors, which after a year were not completed, and in September the council had voted to repeal that CUP. So, I mean, that's the information we have tonight.
Okay. Then we will open the public hearing. Anybody like to come forward and talk? Please come to the podium, state your name, address.
Yeah, my name's Eric Nori. I'm the one here that the appeal is about. I'm the one that paid the $150 to ask for this appeal. So I'm going to do that right now. I have a written copy.
State your address for the record, please.
505 4th Avenue Northwest.
Thank you.
I have some written information I want to give you guys. This isn't everything. It's going to be a combination of written and verbal. But I'll give this to you, Ian. A quick recap here of my opinion why we're here. We applied for a permit for a fence, and at the time, the city code 5154312, all in this one document, four corners of this document, says an access agreement on adjacent property may be required to ensure the ability to maintain the fence without trespassing on a neighboring property. That wasn't an issue until that got changed. And what was changed at the last minute at the city council meeting was an access agreement, which you didn't really mean access agreement, you meant easement. I've got a copy of it right here. Ian sent this easement agreement to my neighbors, which is a different word than access agreement. And that's part of the reason we're here, is because of ambiguity, vagueness, unclear definitions in the ordinance. That's what got us here. And the big problem that got us here was the fact that the actual ordinance called for an access agreement. It didn't say it had to be in writing. It didn't say it had to be notarized or recorded. So I just kind of, as a quick summary, so kind of refresh everybody's memory on kind of what's going on, how we got here. I'm not really sure who's involved in making this decision. I know this is the first time the council's ever revoked a permit, the first time you've ever had a board of adjustments and appeals before, and I got just a couple of questions. One has to do with how long will it take you to make a decision?
Well, that's up to the council.
Guess,
if they feel like they can make a decision tonight, they will. If they don't, then they may hold it over.
Yeah.
I understand that. I expected it would probably take a couple of weeks or maybe even a month. I didn't expect you guys were going to make a decision tonight. I wasn't sure who the people that are voting are, like who are the influential people in this group. I understand we've got a couple of city council members, another, we've got the mayor. Is that all we have for voting tonight? It's two city council members and a mayor? Okay, so will Paul be involved in the decision? I know he's not here, but will, if you guys take this into consideration, will he be involved in making a decision also, or who are the decision makers?
The decision makers are the city council.
Okay, so everybody who's on council. All right. All right, I appreciate you answering those questions. I ask that your decision be sent to me in certified mail, so there's no questions as to when I received it. The way I read the law is if for some reason I choose to appeal this decision that you guys make, that I can appeal it to the district court, and we need to be sure that there's no confusion on the number of days from when I receive my notice from you guys. So I'd ask you, and I think the law says it needs to be certified. I understand the law says you need to put together a transcript from what happens tonight, and if there is an appeal in district court, it is identical to what happens tonight. That's what the importance of the transcript is, so we know what actually went down. I know there's a YouTube video going on, but that's a little hard to get into the courtroom. Not really, but transcript, I think, is what the law is asking you to do. When you granted me the opportunity for this appeal, I heard Tim say, hey, we'll do it, but we've already made up our mind. Is anybody here already made up their mind? No? Okay, I just want to make sure that everybody's open-minded. If you hear new information, if you hear something in a different perspective, that you are open-minded to making a different decision. So I just wanted to bring that up. From when I asked Ian about what the criteria was for this appeal, he said there really isn't any criteria. Appeal however you want. He said there wasn't any application. But if it feels like I'm providing a lot of information tonight, it's because if I don't provide it tonight, I can't provide it to district court in the event we do an appeal. So that's the reason for that. I do believe that the lawsuit that you guys have already filed against me does cast bias in judgment and has caused bias in judgment and could be the reason for an unfair appeal. I'm just mentioning that because the fact that you've started a lawsuit prior to any of the public hearings and any of the appeals. Lawsuit 20CV25622. My appeal tonight, you're going to hear the words unreasonable and arbitrary and capricious, okay? And the reason it's important that I prove those things tonight is those are the things that a judge will look at in addition to law. If you're unreasonable, and at the end of the day, Minnesota does have laws that relate to every single thing to do with the permit, the CUP process, the appeals. The city can't do just whatever they want. At one point, I got an email from the city saying, we can do it however we want. And absolutely, it's not the case. Federal law, state law, trump, everything Kasson does. Kasson doesn't have hometown rule. Even if he did, it still doesn't give you the ability to do whatever you want. The reason we're here is because you said I did not get permission from my neighbors and or an easement agreement written, notarized, signed from my neighbors. And that is unsupported by any rational basis to promote public health, safety, morals, or welfare. There have been no complaints from my neighbors or the community about health, safety, morals, and welfare. Now, you guys have told me there's complaints. You've told me that neighbors have called the police multiple times, the city multiple times, but nobody will give me a copy of any reports. So at this point, that's hearsay. So if we do end up going into appeal, that's not going to be allowed because you guys never provided me any copies of it. We argue that no ordinance violation exists, and that the ordinance does not say that we need a permission from the neighbors, nor does it say that we need written easement agreements notarized and filed. With that, I'm going to go through a quick 7-page summary, and then I'll talk a little bit of case law and talk about some of my sources of my information. I have a 7-page written summary here to the Board of Adjustments and Appeals, City of Casson, November 19th, 6 p.m., Casson Hall. Eric and Betty Norrie appeal a revocation of the conditional use permit for a backyard fence. Please take note this appeal is based on the fact that the City of Casson made an error of law in revoking the Norrie's fence permit, and this is well supported and will be made clear and convincing by a matter of Minnesota law supporting case law, and through this written and verbal appeal and its attachments, including court pleadings. And there is an exhibit list, there's 25 exhibits on it. Furthermore, the City of Casson's decision to revoke the Norrie's fence permit is unsupported by any rational basis relating to promoting public health, safety, morals, or welfare. Norrie's request the Board of Appeals follow the Minnesota laws, Minnesota state statutes, Minnesota case law, and hold themselves to the highest ethical standards while making a decision that benefits the entire community of Casson and not only a small special interest group. Furthermore, we request that the Board follow the guidance provided by the City to the City of Casson by the League of Minnesota Cities through the League's research information memo titled Zoning Guide for Cities, and to consider agreeing with the case law provided by them supporting the League's direction on zoning matters, such as our appeal taking place right now. The City is a member of the League. The City can call the League at any time and get a free second opinion on legal advice. I don't think you've done that, but that guide tells the City exactly how to do things, and it shows case law after case law of how courts rule if you don't. So that's why I'd like you to consider that. I've never heard you even talk about it before in the 200 hours that Ian and everybody spent changing this ordinance, this fence ordinance, after I identified the issues and the real problems, and you guys spent all that time changing it, but you never referenced the great information that the League provides. They've got it all figured out for you on how to develop an ordinance. On July 24, 2024, the City Council of Casson approved the Norrie's permit to build a residential fence, as their fence plan and permit application met all the requirements of the City Fence Code. The Norrie's were clear with the City that they, along with their neighbors, refused to enter into any written agreements as a condition of the permit. Knowing with 100% certainty that no written agreements would ever come to fruition, the City of Casson placed a condition on the permit that a written easement agreement was required with the sole intent to stop the fence project by acting fraudulently and in bad faith. The appeal is a direct result of the City of Casson's poorly drafted, unclear, and ambiguous language in its fence ordinance that says that access agreements may be required, yet the City of Casson's interpretation of the ordinance actually means to the City, to you guys, council, that an access agreement is actually an easement agreement, and such agreement needs to be in writing, signed, notarized, and filed with the deed to your home for the permit to be built, to be valid. It's a big issue, guys. You used to call it an easement agreement, but at one point Dan said, stop calling it that. Stop calling it that. Maybe it sounds bad. Maybe easement sounded too bad. In order to state, the ordinance says one thing and the City believes it actually means something different. That's arbitrary. I've included in your packet a case law regarding Frank's nursery sales versus the City of Roseville Supreme Court, a case from 1980. And when an ordinance is ruled ambiguous and unclear by the courts, they rule in favor of the landowner against the city because they they figured it was the city's job to write a clear ordinance. Wasn't the landowner's job, it was the city's job. That's why we're here. We're here because of a vague, ambiguous, unreasonable ordinance. The lawyers argue that the easement agreement condition is not in accordance with the written ordinance. It's arbitrary, confiscatory, and unsupported by any rational basis related to public health, safety, morals, or welfare. The lawyers argue that the city stepped outside of the law of Minnesota Statute 462-3595 and made an error when using a conditional use permit, when the city used a conditional use permit for the northeast residential backyard fence. By law, a conditional use permit required the parties in the agreement to be in agreement to the conditions of the permit, and the parties were in total disagreement. This is a statute right here, off the reservoir, and it says that the city can use the CUP for certain types of developments, including planned unit developments and certain type of land development activities such as conditional uses. Well, most cities list their conditional uses and their permitted uses, and they're pretty clear. During this time frame, you guys offered fences under both. That was wrong. You shouldn't even have been using a conditional use permit. And the good news is when I brought it up to you, you quickly acknowledged that you were wrong, and you, within less than a month, you'd made the decision to stop the practice. And I appreciate that. That was quick response to fixing the problem. It did take about four or five months before you passed a new ordinance, but you immediately recognized that that was the wrong thing to do. Subsection 3, it says duration. A conditional use permit shall remain in effect as long as the conditions agreed upon were observed. Nobody's never agreed to any conditions. You guys put together a resolution that we were completely opposed to. A resolution means agreement. So you basically, as I was sitting up here saying, we do not agree to this, and my neighbors saying the same thing. They had letters, they gave you all letters saying, we do not agree to this. At the end of the day, that caused a real problem. And we'll get back to that. Cassie Spencer has failed to establish the conditions or standards required to allow the conditional use. Law also says that you need to put in your ordinance, and I mean, I'm talking this ordinance right here. You should have had in here how to meet the conditions. In here, it doesn't say anything about getting an easement. But that was supposed to be a condition that doesn't. What it says is an access agreement. That's where we're having this issue. Courts often find ordinances that fail to establish the standards for granting listed conditional uses problematic and may invalidate the conditional use part of the permit. Rick Murray notified the City of Casson in June of 2024 that the use of a CUP was an error and it was the wrong way to issue fence permits, and the City of Casson could not enforce conditions upon the Norries not reflected in the ordinance or in accordance with the supported fence or in accordance with the supported in the fence in the fence's written ordinance. That's where we got off on the wrong track, guys. Because when I looked at your ordinance, and I said, yeah, I read it. It says an access agreement may be required. May means may or may not. And then Ian says, oh, no. That's not the way we've been doing it. I know the ordinance doesn't say it, but oh, crap. That's where our problem happened. And our problem happened because you guys didn't like it when I told you that you shouldn't be using a conditional use permit. But at the same time, you quickly changed the way you were doing it. And that's important. And I'll get to that in Frank's. The City of Casson Planning and Zoning Board quickly admitted to the issues Nori identified were valid and agreed to change the fence ordinance on July 8th when you had your planning and zoning, when you had Brad, your advisor, step in during the middle of the approval of my permit at the Planning and Zoning Board meeting. All of a sudden it was like Brad on the microphone. You guys, while you were approving my permit, agreed to quit using conditional use and go to a regular permit process. I think that, I don't think you could make it any more obvious that you are changing this because I said this isn't going to work and I'm not doing it. And you changed it to make it clear. You made, to make clear what was unclear. This wasn't the first time people in Caston were having a problem with this ordinance. It's well known. When I came on board, when I went to apply for my permit, people were complaining left and right about why this, what's this, we don't understand this. No, the city around here does this, what's this all about? This is a known issue in the community. Well known to the issue, anybody who's looking at building the fence or has built the fence. Tom Ferris, the chair of the Planning and Zoning Board, refused to approve our permit at two different planning and zoning meetings because he knew the neighbors and the Norries would never enter into a written easement, written agreements for access. Ferris said, this is going nowhere. This is going nowhere. If you refer to the planning and zoning minutes, it's one of my exhibits. I'm going to read this. Alvarez recapped that all four of Norrie's neighbors have submitted letters stating they will not sign the access agreement. Norrie has suggested the fence ordinance and the access agreement need to be rewritten. Chairman Ferris stated that he feels approving this is going nowhere. Did he tell any of you guys that? Okay, at two different meetings, Ferris told you this was going nowhere. What he's talking about going nowhere is approving my permit with the condition that we all sign an access agreement. That's going nowhere. So we got put on the train to nowhere. Our permit got put on some tracks that went over here and had a dead end. You've never done that to anybody before. You've never actually put together a permit for somebody and put it on the tracks that had a dead end. You guys knew it. Everybody knew it. That was done intentionally. All right. We'll come back to that because this going nowhere are probably the most important words of this whole appeal. That you guys put my permit on a path going nowhere. Intentionally. And charged us for it. Neighborhood opinion is another thing that I want to talk about here. Neighborhood opinion in Minnesota states that, Minnesota law states that neighborhood opinion cannot be used to either approve or deny a CUP permit. The opinion of our neighbors against the Norrie's fence cannot be used to influence or deny the permit. I want to roll back real quick. I meant to also talk about a couple other minutes. We've got the July 8th meeting where Mr. Ferris, Chairman Ferris, says, this is going nowhere. We also have another minutes from another Planning and Zoning Board meeting, June 10th, which is also in the packet, that Chairman Ferris stated that all the neighbors have sent letters stating that they will not sign an access agreement, okay? At that meeting, because of the neighborhood opinion, Mr. Ferris said, we can't do this. We can't move forward with Norrie's permit. So two times, Mr. Ferris, probably somebody who has more experience than anybody here in planning and zoning, said, we can't do this. At the city council meeting when I was approved, I've got some minutes here for July 24th, prior to our approval, during my 4 minutes of public comment, I was a bit confused because the ordinance clearly said a neighbor access agreement may be required. And I was like, what conditions may it be required? Because everything in that easement agreement you gave me said that the easement agreement has everything to do with a property line fence. So we weren't doing a property line fence. We applied for a fence 4 inches off the bound, off the property line. Our application was clear on that. So I'm sitting here going, what's up with this? So Attorney Leth, she was so kind to say, would you like me to answer the question? I said, yes. And in the minutes for the meeting, right before you approved my permit with the condition in there to sabotage the deal on the train going nowhere. Les stated that the agreement must be signed by the neighbor if you intend to build on the property line. So at that meeting, I held the agreement up. I held that easement agreement up, and I said, well, Les, this means that this doesn't apply to me because I'm not putting mine on the property line. So she clarified that. She clarified it, that it was for property line fences. At that same meeting, neighbor Jerry Berg stepped up and said, you know, change that wording around. He said, I'm the guy that wrote that letter and gave you the letter saying there's no way in hell I'll ever sign an agreement with this guy, Nori. So I want you to change your wording around that says he can't put up his fence unless he gets the agreement from me. Did anybody think that was a problem? Okay, you got me on the train to nowhere already, and then you got Jerry Berg that talks Dan Egler here into, and when you talked him into it, Dan's response was, well, that ought to do it. Ought to do what? Stop us from building? Yeah, I'd say. So, fence entirely on Norrie's property. The Norrie's originally applied for the fence permit on May 16th, stating that it would be 4 inches off the line. While at the city council meeting, just moments before the permit was approved, I asked Ms. Leth, what's in this report, and she clarified, arbitrary enforcement of conditional use permits. One of the other problems that Ian admitted to right off the bat when I told him this conditional use permit thing is not in your ordinance. You don't, we don't have to do it because you can't just make stuff up verbally. He said, yeah, we're really having a tough time with that. I got about a dozen of them on my desk that I can't get the neighbors to sign because the way this worked, even in my situation, is once you guys put that clause in there and you put us on the train to nowhere, Ian basically said, I'll get this done because we gave you guys $230 to draft the easements and to get the neighbors to sign them originally because that was the only way we could get an opportunity to apply. So Ian said, don't worry. I do this for everybody. I'll get it done. And I thought to myself, holy shit. I think it's unreasonable. The neighbors think it's unreasonable. But Ian's willing to give it a try. Well, at the end of the day, he couldn't pull it off. It was unreasonable. I couldn't pull it off. It was too unreasonable. Now, what might have been reasonable for other people in your community, where everybody knew each other and they all grew up with each other and Ian was persuading them to sign the agreement, maybe it was reasonable for those people, but it sure is. Heck, was not reasonable in my situation where I had the neighbors saying they weren't going to do it in writing multiple times, phoning you guys, telling you they're not going to do it, and we said we weren't going to do it. That changes the reasonable thing a little bit, big time. On the train to nowhere with that one, guys. So you intentionally committed fraud. Further, this appeal claims the city of Cassin committed fraud. Fraud was intentionally committed by the city council by engaging in dishonest dealings when they knowingly placed a condition on the permit that the neighbors and the Norries had to sign a written agreement when it was known with 100% certainty the parties would never do so in a million years. Four of the Norries neighbors provided city letters on 6/5/24, 5 days before our first planning and zoning board meeting, saying they refused to do it. The Norries also objected to such an unreasonable condition. The Planning and Zoning Chairman Tom Ferris refused to approve our permit and said, this is going nowhere. He said it was going nowhere, but somehow or other the City Council thought it was going to go somewhere. You guys thought you put us on a path that we could build the fence. Or didn't you? Will you have put us on a path that we couldn't build? That's something that I'd like you to put in writing in the answer to this. I think every single one of you knew that there was no way written agreements were ever coming. This was not made in good faith. It was actually made with ill intentions to cause malice and stop the fence from getting built to appease our neighbors while keeping our permit money. That's fraud. The condition was very, very, very unreasonable and impossible to meet, and its only intention was to stop the fence from getting built. Minnesota case law shows that unreasonable conditions placed into a CUP only meant to stop a project are not allowed, and fraud's not enforceable. Conditions must be reasonable and agreed to by the parties. That's the law. No community would ever use a conditional use permit and intentionally put something into the permit to stop the project. If anybody in the city knew that there was something was in there that would cause it to fail, or if the applicant knew there was something that would cause it to fail, everybody would stop. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't move forward. That's not the spirit of a conditional use permit. The city, never in good faith would a city place a condition into a CUP that all the parties knew was impossible to meet just to clear the deal. Fraud is not enforceable. Lawyers argue that while we met all the conditions of the fence code and our fence is in compliance with the ordinance and the city code, our permit should be reinstated and made valid again. Lawyers argue that state and federal constitutional concerns override the city's decision, unsupported by any rational basis related to promoting the public health, moral safety, and welfare, as it's related to an access easement agreement. The Lawyers fence is completely built and does not require access to the neighbors for construction or maintenance, making such a requirement futile and lacking a valid purpose. There's no purpose to try to get us to move our fence. You don't have anything in writing that justifies why. At one time, I think Dan Edgar thought this was all about running a 36-inch lawnmower behind the fence, but there's nothing in writing why you guys think a fence needs to be set back 3 feet. And that's a requirement. For the reasons I give this appeal, we expect the Board of Appeals and Adjustments to reverse their decision to revoke our permit. All right, that's part of what we got going on here. I've got some law to argue. Spent a lot of time finding the resources where all the answers are to all this, and there are answers to everything. A city can't just run willy-nilly. There's rules on every single thing, okay? One of my sources is the Land Use and Regulation in Minnesota, a county perspective done by Marcus W. Miller, Chief Civil Division of Stearns County Attorney. Mr. Miller is no longer with the county. He's with an organization called Sourcewell. The Minnesota legislature has put together Sourcewell to advise cities on how to do things right. And I think his guide does just that. And interesting enough, the League of Minnesota Cities guide looks a lot like his. This guide that was put together by him was prepared for training for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. It was used in training for the Minnesota Insurance Trust and County Planning and Zoning Administrators, the MACPZA. Okay, so the information in this document, and this document is about 80 pages. I've only got a few pages here, but I've submitted to you guys the whole 80 pages for your review. And I'm going to go through and talk about a couple of things in here. The first thing that it says is that if an applicant demonstrates that he or she meets the standards and criteria for the issuance detailed in the ordinance, which I must have met the criteria for the issuance detailed in the ordinance. That was that criteria that I was telling you. That isn't real clear. Then the approving authority is obligated to grant the request for the CUP. That's what you did. Controversially, if an applicant cannot demonstrate that he or she meets the standards for the criteria, then the CUP must be denied. Why didn't you deny me? Really? You knew no access agreement would ever get done. The neighbors said they wouldn't do it. We wouldn't do it. Ferris said, let's not do this. Why did City Council not deny me? That's something like you guys to answer in writing. Because it might have been a better option. We still would have appealed it. You know the reason you didn't deny me? It's because you knew you couldn't use neighborhood opinion against me. We met all the criteria. And you knew you couldn't deny me. So you approved me. You put this on a train to nowhere that leads right to nowhere. And that's, you kind of wanted to deny me really bad, but you didn't deny me. You just put a clause in my fence permit that we could never meet to deny us. There's a case law that supports this. Scott County Lumber Company, City of Shakopee, Supreme Minnesota Appeals Court, 1988. Conditional use permits must be recorded. That's another thing that the statute requires. You didn't record mine. You didn't record mine. Well, the conditions of my CUP were meant to protect the public. And the reason they're supposed to record them is so the public can know what's going on. What was there to protect them? I argue that you did not record our CUP because it didn't matter. It didn't matter. There was no conditions in there to protect the public. This document also talks about neighborhood opinion. I want to reference this case right here. It says, the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that although the neighborhood sentiment may be taken into consideration, it may not constitute the sole basis for granting or applying a permit or denying a permit. Northwest College versus City of Arden Hills. This document also talks about the Minnesota 60-day rule, which says you have to approve or deny in 60 days. Doesn't say you can approve me. It actually, there is no wiggle room in the 60-day rule for you guys to, like, deny me a year later. Attorney Les laughing. She thinks there is. If there was, you should have brought it up in court the other day.
You're just misunderstanding the whole rule.
No, the 60-day rule is pretty clear. There's no shenanigans. They put this 60-day rule together to stop communities like you from playing shenanigans and saying you're approved, you're not approved, we're going to play some games with all this stuff. You guys fixed this problem when I brought it up to you. You changed your ordinance. When we get into Frank's, you're going to find that the courts find that very important, that you admitted that your previous version was less clear. And once I brought it to your attention, it was not clear. You changed it to make it very clear. So now I'm going to reference a couple things out of the League of Minnesota Cities guide that they put together, that they really put together for you guys, a zoning guide for cities, really to keep you out of court. It's full of case law. It's full of statutes. Everything in here is supported, just like that other document. The other document had about 150 case laws that support it. This one doesn't have as many, but it has a lot. This document says that it's important that you guys develop a clear, unambiguous ordinance. It's your responsibility that there's not anything that's unclear. It says, when a court resolves a controversy over an undefined or ambiguous word or phrase in a city ordinance, the court may not always interpret the ordinance in the manner the city intended or would prefer. Courts generally give deference to the city's interpretation of the ordinance. When interpreting the language in zoning ordinances, courts generally attempt to find the plain and ordinary meaning of all the terms. Plain and ordinary, access agreement or easement. Okay, that's our issue here, guys. What's the plain and ordinary meaning of the word access agreement? Does it mean easement? Well, I think it means two totally different things. Matter of fact, access agreements are pretty typical. Oftentimes, if a business needs to do a facade because bricks are falling off the front of their building or do a repair on the roof, they need access to the neighbor's property to do that. And it's in the public's best interest for their health and safety. In that situation, oftentimes, there's compensation paid for an access agreement. I don't think Ian offered my neighbors any compensation. Any contract, anytime you try to get someone to sign a contract, you got to give them something. They had no benefit to sign it. But at the end of the day, an access agreement is a normal course of business. And if for some reason your neighbor does not want to give you an access agreement and it's going to be against the public's health and safety, you can go to court and a judge will grant it. And that's exactly what I would do if I needed an access agreement to build a fence. I would go to the court and I would plead to the court and I'd have to provide the court a darn good reason for it. And if I gave them a good enough reason, they grant it to me. A court may set aside or intervene in city zoning decisions in instances where it finds a violation of important constitutional restraints. First, the courts may overrule a city zoning decision when it finds a zoning ordinance is unsupported by any rational basis related to promoting public health, safety, morals, or welfare. Usually in these cases, a court determines that if the city acted in an arbitrary and a capricious manner, which is exactly what you guys did. Second, when a zoning ordinance denies the landowner practically all reasonable use of the land, which would if I set my fence back 3 feet, resulting in a taking of the land without just compensation. This information from the league, you guys. The city of Caston pays dues to the league. I don't know why you wouldn't take the recommendation. I don't know why you wouldn't call and get a second legal opinion. They got great lawyers. They're free. This other document that the league has put together is more geared for the planning and zoning board. The one thing under H, conditional use permits, it says, a conditional use permit does not give a planning commission unfettered discretion to approve or deny a CUP application. This isn't the Wild West, you guys. You can't do anything you want. You have to put your conditions in your ordinance. All right, I'm going to talk about and there's about 50 of these Supreme Court case laws, decisions you guys could refer to. All of the case law numbers are in the information that I provided Ian. I'm not going to argue every one of them, but Frank's Nursery Sales versus the City of Roseville is a well-known case to most lawyers. Same situation. The ordinance said one thing. Frank's thought it said something else. Court determined it was arbitrary. Ruled in favor of Frank's. One thing that was very important in Frank's that I brought up before, and there's several things in here. Let me get to what I got highlighted here, guys. Courts generally strive to construe a term according to its plain and ordinary meaning. Okay, Charles Saxton versus Hayfield, 1962. Case law supports that. Courts generally strive to construe the plain and ordinary meaning. What's the plain and ordinary meaning of access agreement? It doesn't say written. It doesn't say notarized. What is the plain and ordinary meaning of that? So second, zoning ordinances should be construed strictly against the city and in favor of the property owner. Anderson, Retcloth. Basically, it says clearly the term, and I'm going to interject access agreements, is susceptible of various interpretations that are more and less restrictive in scope. Yeah, probably does. That's where we're at. Access agreement to me means talk to your neighbor. To you, it means written, notarized, filed. Okay? But the court must give weight to the interpretation that, while still in the confines of the term, is the least restrictive to the property owner. You guys realize that you weren't clear on that. That you wanted that agreement from people before they could apply. You wanted that agreement before they could build. Your ordinance didn't say it, so you changed your ordinance. That's what the new ordinance is really clear on it. The zoning ordinance must be considered in the light of its underlying policy. Leroy versus City of Mankato, 1950. In this case, an examination of the legislative intent does not dictate a contrary result. Certainly, the administrative interpretation of the ordinance is entitled respect, but that interpretation is not persuasive, particularly here. In France, it says the court could have found that even the council agreed with this interpretation of access agreement until continuing community pressure, me, compelled the council to attempt to redefine the term. It's exactly what you did. The council's attempt to add definition of the term to the ordinance also suggests that it felt the ordinance, absent the new version, was not so restrictive. We get into court, guys, the court's going to say, hey, good job changing that and fixing all the problems. But it's also going to show that you had a bad ordinance that wasn't clear. Got some attachments to go through. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on them, and then I'll get close, so you guys can sleep on this, hopefully, and not push this into district court. And that's fine. District court is going to look at if it's reasonable, unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious. And this is damn well very unreasonable to put somebody on a train to nowhere. That's really unreasonable. So I've got a land use application. I want to just note, I gave you guys a copy of this, as Attorney Leff had stated, that I intended to build the fence 4 inches off the property line. That's exactly what my application said. We didn't apply for anything else. That's what we applied for. At one point you guys did send me a cease and desist letter. And in this cease and desist letter, it says the city staff received complaints that you've begun construction of a perimeter fence in your property. In another one of these you sent me, you said the police department has received plenty of complaints. And as a matter of fact, the police department had received an overwhelming amount of activity. I don't think Josh is up to the public on just how many calls for service and how much time as officers that I had to spend about the fence ordinance. Oh, and when it comes to arbitrary, Chief Hansen came over to my house with the cease and desist, he brought over the new ordinance, the old ordinance, everything, with an attempt to try to convince me that I'm in the wrong. He found it arbitrary. He could not find anywhere in your ordinance that said I had to have an easement signed and notarized. It was unclear to him. It was arbitrary. The letter then goes on to say, your neighbors did not give you permission to build a perimeter fence. That's nowhere in the ordinance. This is hogwash. When I saw this, I said, where in the hell did Leff get this crap? Neighbor's permission? Come on. There's a lot of things that Ian says, hey, we've always done things outside of our ordinance. We've always done things. I don't have information to that. I'm only privy to what you put in writing. And I'm only bound to what's in writing. I'm not bound to all the he said, she said stuff, and we've always done it this way, and I should have known because I was told. It's not that I was told. If it wasn't in your ordinance, you can't tell me to do it. Sorry if I sound a little bit pissy, but that's how I feel about it. On September 19th, I got a letter from Ian from the city. It let me know that you've adopted a resolution to revoke a permit, but that $230 that I paid the city and Ian to procure the easement access agreements that Ian worked his butt off trying to get done, but couldn't because it was unreasonable. It was unreasonable. He tried. He sent them to the neighbors. That I think it was November, December. I got word back that he couldn't do it. He didn't say it was because it was unreasonable. He didn't say why. He didn't say what led him to not be able to accomplish it. But I've got to assume, because the neighbors had provided letters prior to my application, which is right here, this letter saying, I will not provide an access agreement to enter my property. This might have been one of the reasons why Ian had a hard time getting him to sign it, because he said he wouldn't. Now, I'll be honest, I told Ian, if you get it done, if you get that miracle done, Ian, I'll sign it too. But they got to sign it first, because I knew he couldn't get it done. The neighbors put together a letter saying they wouldn't do it. But anyways, at the end of the day, I think you guys realized, and I think exact words that Paul used, is he said, we didn't provide the easement service to Mr. Norrie. And it was an easement service. I give you the money, Leff drafts the agreement, Ian gets the neighbors to sign it, you guys notarize it and file it. That is an easement service. You didn't do it. Okay, so, thank you, you gave back the money. This says a refund of $230 is paid when your CUP application was originally submitted. It's saying you're giving that money back. Then it says, note that the $300 CUP application fee is non-refundable. Well, folks, you charged me a $300 permit fee, not an application fee. There was no application fee. On the application, Ian, You're waving your head. If there was an application fee on here, it would say application fee. There's no application fee. This is the application. hey, sorry to use the exact words, Ian, but that is the application. Okay, the fees were for the permit. That's my argument to the court. If you guys decide, hey, let's push this to the court, that's how I see it, okay? Couple other documents here. All right. This is a property damage release. It's in your form. It's from Stephen Johnson's Insurance Company. For when he trespassed on my property, paid Cody Snowmather able to cut down my trees, okay? His insurance company paid out. He claimed negligence. The reason I'm bringing this up is because I think this might be part of our problem. I think this might be part of the problem why the neighbors have gone batshit crazy over our fence, okay? This has caused a lot of problems. You guys led my neighbors to believe that my neighbors' rights were being violated by us building our fence 4 inches off the property line, and they went crazy. The Casson police had to get involved multiple times with a neighbor, Todd Vucevic. And included in your packet is this. I advised Todd that while his behavior is typically legal, the fact that it plainly appears intended to intimidate and harass. It says, Todd says, yeah, when Betty goes outside, I go out and take pictures of the property line. He's out here at 1 o'clock in the morning with his camera taking pictures. This is a result of something you guys told him. He wasn't real clear. He couldn't really explain to the officer why he's doing this. So in your packet is this information. This is an ICR number 2025-00003263. It's by officer 3324. There's body camera for this one. Anybody were to want to know what really happened there. But at the end of the day, all the neighbors, all of a sudden, because they thought their rights were getting violated, started to try to police the deal. This neighbor, Todd Vucevic, asked the police if they could physically stop me from building the fence. You guys need to take a deep look inside and look at the problems this fence ordinance has caused. It's unreasonable, arbitrary, it's capricious. No ordinance violation existed. We never agreed to get an easement from our neighbors. It's like as I was at the meeting telling you guys, no, we're not going to do it, our neighbors aren't going to do it. It's almost like one of you took the back of your heel out of my neck and was holding me down as I was yelling, no. And he said, you agree, here's our resolution, we demand you do this. That's not how a conditional use permit works. The terms in a conditional use permit are agreed to. They're not one-sided. They're not, we're just going to shove it down your throat. Once again, that goes back to the fact. When I told you I would not do that under any conditions, and neither would my neighbors, just like you do now, if somebody came into Ian and they said, you know what, Ian, I will not get that easement again from the neighbors, Ian wouldn't even let him apply for a permit. He'd say, well, we're not doing this. Why didn't you guys say that then? That's why a court needs to figure this out, because there are some real issues here. This was done intentionally. The zoning ordinance, and this is straight from an attorney, by the way, must identify, and I have talked to several attorneys, the factors that your town will use to approve or disapprove a CUP application. Your zoning ordinance must identify the factors that your town will use to approve or disapprove. It didn't include the factors. And if it does not, and yours did not, you can only consider the factors your zoning ordinance outlines. The attorney basically said if you don't, call him and he'll help you fix your problems. Arbitrary, reasonableness, capricious. The judicial review of this appeal is granted when the ordinance is arbitrary, not reasonable, capricious, and the board does not follow the state law. There's laws that control all these things. The state controls everything the town does, and case law supports this. I know right now it's going on a lot of times, states maybe don't want to follow federal law, and maybe towns don't want to follow state law. But laws are there for a reason, you guys, and I'm asking you right here tonight to follow the law. Look at how the law applies to what's happened so far, okay? The reason that we're here is because you did not follow the law. I'm going to close with Tom Ferris' words that he said, this is going nowhere. We're real. Nobody listened to Tom Ferris. Or did you listen to Tom Ferris and say, let's put noise on a train to nowhere? Nobody else in the community was treated like we were. We went down to Manorville. We went down and looked up to see who all got their CUPs filed, or who all got the resolutions filed, who got the neighbors agreements done, who didn't. Went through the last couple of years of people that applied for CUPs. In the littlest 2 years' time, we found 14 other people that did not get their neighbors agreements done. Probably a dozen of them were the ones that were on Ian's desk the whole time that he couldn't get done. 14 other people. Why are you going after me? And if you do go after me, are you going to start going after those other people? And the last thing I want to do is cause a problem for anybody in this town. But at the same time, we're getting discriminated against. We're being treated unfairly. We're being singled out. So with that being said, I ask that you take our permit that you placed on that road to nowhere. And you back that train up to the switch, and you put our permit on a path to go somewhere so that we, like everybody else, have a valid permit. I mean, this whole thing about an easement agreement, I looked up this morning how easy it is to remove the easement agreements. And Ian is doing no enforcement to check and see who has signed up for it and who has not, or who actually did it and who didn't. So, going nowhere, train to nowhere. You guys knew this was going nowhere. You intentionally put that clause in there when you should have just simply denied us so that we could go through the same process. We would have appealed it for the $150, then we would have taken it to district court, which is what I recommend anybody do that can't build a fence right now. You guys got to give them a letter of denial so they can come do this appeal and they can go to district court. Because if you need an action of building from your neighbors, if you really need it, and you can prove to the court that you need it, they will grant it. Please reconsider this issue with our permit. We want a permit issued for our fence without any conditions. You guys have granted several fence permits without conditions. You recently granted a sign permit for a business, a conditional use permit with no conditions. So if I'm asking for a conditional use permit without conditions, that's a really easy fix for you guys. You keep the $300, we paid our permit fee, we met all the conditions. But what are we doing here, guys? With that being said, I hope you enjoyed my presentation. Send me a certified letter. Put together a transcript of this. That's what the law states. Thanks a lot. Appreciate all your time, everybody.
Is there anyone else that would like to come forward and talk on conditional use permit revocation? Okay, I'm seeing none.
Don't background information right there.
Lost track of the discussion here, so this is going to be spotty.
State your name and address.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jerry Berg, 506 Fifth Avenue Northwest.
Thank you, Jerry.
Yep. I'll try to straighten this out. One of the first conversations I had with my neighbor, Mr. Norrie, I don't know if it was the first one or the second one, but either the first or second comment was, he said he was going to sue the city of Casson and me so he could put a fence up. This was way before the permit was applied for. Along with that, my primary reason for not signing any agreement or basically being against the process is I was afraid that any damage done to the fence by weed whipping or scraping it with mower or something, I would be sued. That has to do with safety and stuff with the neighbors, I think. Let's see. And I think I stated that, it's probably on tape on, I think it was the first planning and zoning meeting when he applied for the permit, stated that I was afraid of liability due to, from any damage that I'd be sued then. Nearly, I think it might have been the last planning and zoning meeting before it was recommended to the council. I don't know if it was planning and zoning or ended up being the city council comment. Something was made to the fact that one of the reasons they went ahead with the permit and put the condition on there was there was hope that there'd be some way that neighbors get together and sign permits and whatnot. And that might have been predicated on the fact that one of the previous meetings before that, I made a comment to one of the council members after the meeting, it wasn't on tape. I thought I had some possible solution that we could, as neighbors, get together. I think it was that same meeting. I tried to talk to Mr. Norrie in the back of the room before, well, quite a few people had left, but he was discussing with someone else something, and I waited a while, and I tried to break into, maybe try to discuss what I had in mind, and I could not get a word in edgewise, so I gave up last time I talked about it. Also, another thing, one of the meetings, and I don't know where it was one of the planning and zoning fairly early on, I think Mr. Norrie made the comment, something to the effect that why would anybody sign one of these agreements because of the liability of you're giving access to your property, anybody to own your property in the future, access to their, or them access to your property. Just some background. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? Okay, seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. Any discussion for council tonight?
So the fence was built even after all of this?
Correct.
I'm fine with keeping it as we decided last meeting. In the 511 emails and 70 or so voicemails, I think that's enough information after today and those different contacts from Mr. Noy that we've heard a lot, but it hasn't changed the fact that we went through all this process and I still disagree. So I'm fine keeping it the way it is.
I don't quite understand what the end game is here. The fence was built without the proper permitting because it was the conditional use permit was revoked. The neighbors clearly have concerns over liability if the fence is built on the property line. If the conditional use permit is put back into place, there's a 3-foot setback because that's what was in effect at the time the conditional use permit was issued. The present law is only a 2-foot setback, correct?
Correct.
So I don't see why reinstating the conditional use permit would be of any benefit to the plaintiff in this instance. So I don't see a reason to do it.
Okay.
This is not a personal decision. I don't know any of you more than what we have had conversations here over the phone. I don't think I've ever seen Steve Johnson in a meeting. I've never seen him outside of a meeting. I know who he is because his dad was my pastor. Otherwise, I've never had a conversation with him. So a lot of the accusations through voicemail and email and even today, I would say are a stretch or inaccurate.
Well, and then he brings up health and safety. If you look at, if you build something on somebody's property line, granted, you own part of the property line, they own part of the property line, but as soon as you access the neighbor's property without permission, without an agreement, if you, Jerry talks about scuffing events, what happens if you fall and get injured? Is you going to sue the neighbor because you're on their property, but you're looking at your fence? And then there was a time and we had discussed even at planning and zoning and brought up that you could do an agreement with a certified builder who was insured to go and maintain the fence, or a lawn mowing service who was insured and certified to mow it if you wanted on property line. And that was part of an access agreement. It could have an easy access agreement. And that had been brought up more than once in discussion. And I think Jerry even and kind of somewhat mentioned something similar to that, you know. But I don't, looking at the facts, like you brought up, Mel, if we go back and reverse the replication, now you would have to be 3 feet off and still have access agreement. The new ordinance is 2 feet in access agreement, if you're within 2 feet, because we define property line in these ordinances to be within the fence to be within 2 feet or 3 feet, depending on which one. So I agree with you.
Would the fence be moved if we reinstated it?
It would have to be, otherwise it wouldn't meet the conditions. Then it'd still be a violation of the conditional use permit. So in the way it's worded, you'd be better off if it was revocated and you were 2 feet instead of 3 feet. Because then you still own the property, you just now have 2 feet on the outside that you maintain.
I want to clarify something. Yes. Based on what you just said, you still own the property regardless.
Right.
That's not an issue. This is not a city taking. We're not taking anyone's
right.
property
never,
for public use.
No, we never planned on that. It's never been. It's always your property. We're just putting the fence in to protect you and your neighbors. Because it protects you as the homeowner, too.
Moving the fence in?
Yes.
Moving the fence inside of the property.
Yes. Because then you're never, ever on your neighbor's property. Then there's no trespassing, there's no liability issues. So, well, with that,
any thoughts from our attorney?
Yes.
The two things, I understand that the Norries do not agree that the conditions that were placed on their permit were reasonable. I disagree. I believe that those conditions were reasonable. And the city can't do whatever it wants, but it can place whatever conditions it deems reasonable onto a conditional use permit. They don't have to agree to those conditions. So those are the two points. I know that they don't agree with me, but I believe the condition was reasonable, and they don't have to agree to it.
So, with that, would we?
Well,
I mean, there's been no.
Either you know, you could take two actions. You could vote to, you know, overturn your previous decision, or you could say we're going to reject the appeal. I mean, those would be the two things. Or you could table it to a future meeting. That's the actions you could take tonight if you chose to do so.
Well, I don't.
Revoking your previous decision or tabling.
Well, I don't, in my opinion, I don't see tabling it benefits because there's no new evidence brought forth tonight, and there was no new evidence since the first, when we issued the revocation. There's none, no new information. That's my opinion. I
agree.
Yes. I would from the discussion, I guess I would look for a motion to affirm the, that we, the revocation of the conditional use permit for the Nori fence located at 505 Fourth Avenue Northwest.
Make that motion.
Thank you, Ryan.
Sorry.
So we...
A second.
A second. We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Pose. Motion carries. Next, we have correspondence. Is there anything in there that you'd like to discuss? I see there is a couple certificates for Sarah, who I see had left, but I'd like to thank her for putting in her time and getting certified in from the Minnesota Government Finance Office Association. And I think Linda got something she'd sent out too, for the clerks.
The article?
The article, yes. Yes, so that, I'd like to bring that up. That was quite the honor. So, other than that, I would take a motion to adjourn.
Make the motion to adjourn.
Thank you.
Second.
You. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, everybody.